Today's passages for consideration will be Numbers chapter 20, verses 14 through 21, as well as chapters 21, 1 through 3, and 21, 21 through 35. And as usual, we'll reach into some other supporting verses as well, particularly in Deuteronomy chapters 2 and 3. Today's passages are significantly broken up because we'll be considering several relatively short narratives which are all somewhat similar in nature, or at least which share a common theme. And, at least for now, we'll be skipping over the narratives which separate them. And our theme is that of Israel in the wilderness, engaging in conflict with the nations surrounding the Promised Land. A mere six chapters ago, and much of those six concerned with religious ceremony, Israel was forbidden from entering the Promised Land for 40 years. Well, time flies when you're having fun wandering around and waiting to die in the wilderness, because now in chapter 20, we've already reached the 40th year of wandering. Now, not every single man of the cursed generation has died yet. Moses won't die until the last minute, and though we discussed his death last week, Aaron is still alive for some of today's events. So Israel still has a year to wander, and there will be a fair amount of action in this last year. But while they may not yet be prepared to enter the Promised Land for a while to come, Israel is close enough to the end of their sentence that they are preparing to go down the correct route to get there. In short, the invasion of the Promised Land is nigh, but they'll have to get to the Promised Land before they can attack it, and to do that, they're going to have to get through the other nations first. And today's passages tell us how they did it. As a reminder, if you didn't catch it the first time, your passages for consideration are Numbers chapter 20, verses 14 through 21, and also Numbers chapter 21, verses 1 through 3, and 21 through 35. So then, if you haven't yet read your passages, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Now, before we can get on to a fair consideration of the passage, we've got to have an idea of what the map looks like. Now, if you want to look at a map of the Old Testament wanderings and conquest, I'm sure that you can do that on the internet with little trouble, and I recommend that you do so. But since we're communicating through an audio medium, let's use a clock face to give us a mental visual, and I'll describe the relative positions of the places in question. At the center of your clock is the Promised Land of Canaan. That's Israel's goal. Israel is somewhere south of that goal, below approximately 5 and 6 o'clock. And all around the clock face are barriers keeping Israel from walking into Canaan. West of Canaan, at 7 through 11 o'clock, is the Mediterranean Sea, not the optimal route for entry. At 6 o'clock, due south, we have the Negev, or southland of Canaan, populated by well-fortified Canaanites. At 5 o'clock, we have Edom living around Mount Seir. At 4:30 is Moab, and at 4 o'clock is Ammon. At 3 o'clock are the Amorites, who will get much attention today. North of that are Arameans, whom we won't discuss. Further complicating matters are the waterways. Between all these nations and the Promised Land is the Dead or Salt Sea and the Jordan River north of that. So it isn't enough to just get past any one country and then run to the center. They have to get past a country which is adjacent to a waterway which they can reasonably expect to cross. So Israel has a goal. They're entering the Promised Land. Their point of entry will be from the east, the land of the Amorites, where they will cross the Jordan River. So before they can enter Canaan at the middle of our clock face, they've got to get themselves up to 3 o'clock. So how are they going to get there? The most direct route is to cut straight across Edom, Moab, and Ammon, 4 and 5 o'clock, into the land of the Amorites to cross the river there. Well, when we get into the story, we're going to find that Edom and Moab are not so keen on the idea of a horde of Israelites cutting directly across their territory. So Israel will end up going around them, skirting along their edges. And we recall that national borders were more loose at that time than they are today, so it isn't exactly clear on where a border is at times. At the end of the day, a nation's border was whatever point they chose to defend. So Israel will be going through Edom without quite going through Edom, and going through Moab without quite going through it. You'll see what I mean. So here's the path. Israel starts out south of 5 o'clock. They ask Edom, "Can we pass through?" The answer is no, so they cut west, skirting across the edges of Edom and the Negev between 5 and 6 o'clock. There, they're forced to fight Canaanites at Arad. That gets them to the Dead Sea, arguably Edomite territory. But now they're passing north of Edom's 5 o'clock. So they cut across the waterways near the Dead Sea, and they want to go straight through Moab at 4 o'clock on their way to 3 o'clock. Moab says no. So Israel is left to skirt along the edges on the east side of the Dead Sea, arguably passing through Moab without quite doing so. Then they get to the edge of 3 o'clock. They need to set themselves up for a full-scale military invasion across the Jordan River. But the Amorites say, no, you can't skirt the edge of our territory, you can't be here, and you can't use our land to launch this invasion, we're attacking you. So Israel defeats the Amorites and takes all of their land east of the Jordan. Now they're ready to launch their full attack. With that summary of the map in mind, let's dig into the passage and get the details of the narrative. Our passage begins at the southern borders of Edom, and that warrants a quick reminder of who Edom is. The Israelites are the sons of Jacob, whom we studied in Genesis 25-50 from October of 2016 to May of 2017. And if you studied that with us, you recall that Jacob had a twin brother named Esau. Esau was also called Edom. While God promised the land of Canaan to Jacob, he gave Esau the land of Seir, southeast of Canaan, roughly correlated to modern-day Bozrah. And of course, since his descendants filled the land, Seir became the land of the Edomites. We note, citing Deuteronomy 2:12 and 2:22, that the Edomites did not take this land peacefully. There were Horites living in the land when Esau's descendants started to expand, and Edom took the land from the Horites by force. These Horites are mentioned at the same time as the Rephaim, the giants, but we have no clear indication that these were also giants. Regardless, Edom is an opponent of Israel, but not in the same way that Canaan is, because there's an ancestral relationship there. Israel is out to destroy Canaan and possess their land, but they view Edom with some degree of familial affection, however small, and have no interest in disturbing them. Now Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 1 through 8, complement the narrative concerning Edom found in Numbers. There, in Deuteronomy, we read that the children of Israel had, for some time, been traveling around Mount Seir, moving in the direction of what we would call the Red Sea. That indicates to me that they were moving west from the wilderness toward the Sinai Peninsula, into the Negev, or the southern portion of what would later become Judah. This, we note from verse 14 of the chapter, was in the 38th year of wilderness wandering, so a year or so before the death of Aaron. And as the people of Israel attempt to make a difficult pass south around Edom's territory, Jehovah spoke to Moses and tells them to stop and to travel directly north through Edom's country instead. In those instructions, God makes a peaceful intent very clear. Israel will have none of Edom's land because God had given it to Edom. Israel was not to fight with Edom. They were not to steal any of Edom's things. Any food they ate or water they drank, they were to pay for. That, of course, could have proved to be quite expensive, but God justifies it by noting that he had been with them in the wilderness, and that while their travel had been difficult, he had provided for all of their needs. For that reason, then, they should not be concerned with whether or not they would be able to pay Edom, because God would provide. So Moses sent messengers to Edom, faithfully delivering the message as described in Numbers 20. After briefly reviewing the history of God, delivering them all from Egypt, and sending them to Kadesh in the wilderness, Moses makes his request. Let us pass through, on the road, not in your fields, and let us pay for anything we need as we come through. But just as God promised, the Edomites did not trust Israel and were afraid of them. So the king of Edom returned a threat. If you try to pass through here, we're going to attack you. Israel returned another message with essentially the same content. Edom still refused, and this time sent out an army capable of stopping Israel from entering. With that, Israel gave up and turned back. Note that Deuteronomy 2:29 implies that Edom and Moab did give Israel some kind of passage, or peaceful relations. This is because Israel did pass through the edges of the land and did deal with the people living there, even though they did not pass directly through the land's center. Chronologically, the next event after the trouble with Edom is the death of Aaron, and then comes the conflict with Arad. As for who, or what, Arad is, there is some question. In the first place, depending on the translation you use, you might read that Arad is a city with a king, or you might read that Arad is the king of a city. In either case, it is clear that there is a city called Arad somewhere in the south end of the Promised Land, in what will later become Judah's territory. We have clear mention of it as a place in Judges 1:16. However, that is not to say that Arad might not also be a person's name. Perhaps he was named after his city, or perhaps the king assumed the name of the city when he assumed control of it, or perhaps he named the city after himself. So, is this person to be called King Arad or the King of Arad? Well, I'll leave that conflict for greater minds to sort out. Unfortunately, we also have very little context into which we can put this conflict with Arad. This is the first mention of Arad in the Bible, and the three other mentions of it give little or no information about who these people were. All that we really know is that there is a city called Arad in the south of Canaan, populated by Canaanites. The king of Arad, we are told, both in Numbers 21:1 and Numbers 33:40, heard that the Israelites were advancing toward his position. The ESV tells us that Israel was moving toward his city by a way called Atharim. That word, Atharim, is of uncertain meaning, so the ESV renders it as a proper place name. The KJV calls it the Way of the Spies, but I can see no reason for them to have done so. This, evidently, is a borderline no-man's land between Edom and Canaanite Negev. That aside, because the king heard in advance that they were coming, he was able to fight against Israel and to take some Israelites captive. And that made Israel angry. It was an unprovoked attack, and they were not willing to let those men go. And so they sought Jehovah's help in the matter, promising that if he would return the people, they would devote the cities of Arad to destruction. The intent there is that the city would be used as a sacrifice. The people of Israel would take no plunder. They wouldn't make slaves of the people. They wouldn't keep the livestock. They wouldn't hoard the treasures. They wouldn't live in the buildings. They stood to gain nothing from the conquest. Rather, if he would simply meet their request of giving them their people back, they would give everything they won in the battle to God, most likely destroying it by his sacrificial fire. And evidently, that was a trade Jehovah was willing to make. Israel defeated Arad and devoted the cities associated therewith to destruction. And since we do have some later mention of the city, we suppose that it was rebuilt or built over in a later generation, as was very common in ancient civilization. In Deuteronomy 2:8-22, we have an account concerning Israel's interaction with Moab and Ammon, our 4 o'clock. The Moabites, you may recall, are also relatives of Israel, having descended from Abraham's nephew Lot. For more on Moab and Ammon, you might give a listen to the message Lot and His Daughters, published August 14, 2016. Much as Edom got some respect for their Abrahamic ties, so did the descendants of Lot. God told Israel specifically not to harass Moab, because he had given them their land. They had taken it from the giants, whom they called the Emim. He also told them as they traveled not to bother the people of Ammon. The Ammonites were also descended from Lot and took their land from giants whom they called the Zamzumim. Also of note, while we're talking about giants, Deuteronomy 2:23 mentions the Kaphtorim defeating the Avim, their word for the giants, in Gaza. These Kaphtorim, we believe, were the ancient ancestors of the Philistines. So the record here indicates that essentially all of the peoples living in this region had to contend with a race of giants before they could populate their portion of the land. And evidently there was some genetic intermingling of the giants with the victorious groups, from which we get characters like Goliath later on. But history of giants aside, Israel passed by the edge of Moab and Ammon, sticking close to the sea. And then the real fireworks start with the Amorites at 3 o'clock. And there they pulled off a great victory against two Amorite kings, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan. These would be big victories for Israel, later memorialized in Psalms like 135 and 136, and also mentioned many times in recollections of Israel's history. It is here that Israel will gain their first permanent pieces of land, and their defeat of these two kings will demoralize their future opponents in Canaan. We have it noted in Joshua 2:10 that these victories made the people of Canaan afraid of Israel. So fearful, in fact, that Joshua 9:10 lists them as the inspiration for the Gibeonite deception, but we'll get to that another day. For now, we're talking about battles with the Amorite kings. So who were the Amorites? Looking back at the table of nations in Genesis 10, we see that the Amorites were descendants of Canaan. That, of course, means that they do not share any meaningful relationship connection to Israel, who descended from Canaan's uncle Shem. That connection goes all the way back to the time of Noah. And since we haven't mentioned Noah in a long time, it might be worthwhile to remind you that Canaan, father of the Amorites, was cursed by Noah in Genesis chapter 9. So, these are cursed Canaanites, and they aren't going to get much respect from the Israelites. And furthermore, where God told Israel not to take a single foot width of Edom's land, their whole point in traveling is to take the land of Canaanites, and Canaanites these be. Numbers 21:21-30 gives us the story of the defeat of Sihon the Amorite at a city called Heshbon. It started with the same peaceful request that Moses had made of Edom. Let us pass through. We'll stay on the road and not take a thing unless we pay for it. But Deuteronomy 2:30 tells us that God hardened Sihon's heart, much as he had done to Pharaoh. See our message from August 6, 2017. So Sihon had the same reaction that the king of Edom had. No way. And just as Edom had, he amassed his army and went out to fight. Well, Israel showed some deference to Edom, but Sihon got no such luck. Deuteronomy 2:24 records that God had given Moses orders to take possession of Sihon's land, and that they should fight against him. So that's what happened. Israel killed Sihon's army with the sword, and when the land was left open to them, they spread out across it, claiming it as their own. In doing so, we are told in Deuteronomy 2, Israel left no one alive. They killed the men, they killed the women, they killed the children. Every person was devoted to destruction as an offering for Jehovah. Israel did take the livestock and other property, however. As for the ramifications concerning genocide, expect a message on that at some point in the next 6 months. Having conquered the Amorites who lived under the rule of Sihon, Moses and the Israelites next conquered the nearby city of Jazer and turned their attention to a region called Bashan, ruled by a king named Og. Of note, Joshua 12:4-5 tells us that Og was one of the remnant of the Rephaim, a giant, and Deuteronomy 3:11 agrees with that assessment. That verse also provides a detail about his bed. It was 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide, about 14.5 feet by 6 feet. That bed was made of iron, and at the time that Deuteronomy was written, it was still extant in a city called Rabbah, where anyone could see it as evidence of Og's great stature. When Israel's army marched out against Og, God gave Moses a word of encouragement, that he should have no fear of Og, because Og and his people would be defeated just as Sihon was before him. And that indeed is what happened. Every one of Og's people was killed. No survivors remained. Deuteronomy 3 provides some supplementary information. With Og dead, Israel took all of his land, keeping the livestock and the treasures for themselves, but devoting the cities and all the people to destruction, just as they had done with all that was under Sihon's rule. Herein, Israel has taken possession of their first piece of land. They won it by fighting against the Amorites, whom they completely destroyed, at least in the East Jordan area. They got there by taking a serpentine route, skirting the edges of Edom, the Negev, Moab, and Ammon. While they fought Canaanites in the Negev when they found them, they did not resist the hostile advances of the Abrahamic peoples in the surrounding area. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.